Quality sleep is essential. That's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature? Sleep Number Smart Beds let you individualize your comfort, so you sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 40% on the Sleep Number Limited Edition Smart Bed for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at Sleep Number stores or sleepnumber.com.
It looks like the stars have been scattered across the ground. Have you ever seen anything so full of splendor? So soon?
They'll be expecting us.
Will you bring me back? I'd like to see it again.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to Decoding Westworld, a recap podcast about the HBO original series Westworld. I'm David Chen.
I'm Joanna Robinson.
And welcome to the show. What we do here on this podcast is we dive in depth into every episode of Westworld. We don't spoil anything from future episodes. That includes anything from the next time on preview of the show. You can find more episodes of this podcast at decodingwestworld.com. You can also email us at decodingwestworld@gmail.com. Before we get going, want to do some announcements. Want to get to some emails at decodingwestworld@gmail.com and then dive into this episode, Joanna. But an announcement, there was a new season of Westworld was announced, right? Like season three is going to happen.
Sure is.
So that's very exciting. It means, you know, that people at HBO like what's going on with the show, and it's getting enough ratings to sustain another season. So we have that to look forward to. Who knows how long it will be until the next season? You know, it could be a couple years.
Sure.
But that is very exciting.
That's okay. They've got a little show called Game of Thrones next year. So
yes.
I don't know if you've heard of it. So.
No, I haven't. And also wanted to point out, we're still getting some questions about when episodes of this podcast will be released. In general, Wednesday night, although we will try to get them out sooner. But yeah, episodes of Decoding Westworld are out Wednesday night this year, just because of a lot of scheduling things going on with us. So wanted to make those couple of announcements. We also got a bunch of emails this week, and I wanted to read some of them. So let's see. We got a bunch of emails about the use of the entertainer. Apparently no one liked my explanation of why there was the entertainer, the song played on the piano for season 2, episode 1. And here comes one of the emails from Cheryl, who writes into decodingwestworld@gmail.com. Wanted to drop you a note to remind you that the music on the piano, the entertainer, is used in the movie The Sting with Robert Redford and Paul Newman. In The Sting, the audience is just as surprised as the person who is conned in the movie. We think Redford rats out Newman's character when, in fact, that was part of the plan. We also think Redford is killed before the big reveal. Perhaps the music here is a foreshadowing of such a twist? That's an email from Cheryl and many other people saying that the entertainer could have been a reference to the movie The Sting. What do you think, Joanna?
I do know. I mean, I knew that the entertainer was a song used most identified with the movie The Sting, or either that or people who played piano. Did you play piano growing up?
I did, yeah.
Did you play The Entertainer and or Maple Leaf Rag?
I don't know if I played The Entertainer, but I definitely did ragtime stuff. So
okay.
Yeah.
Joplin. Anyway, it could be a reference to The Sting. I'm sure there are certainly people who are like conning people and twists and all that kind of stuff. This is going to shock you, Dave.
I'm shocked already right now.
Because I know about the Maple Leaf Rag. This is going to shock you. I still think my explanation's right.
Okay, fair enough. And what was your explanation, just so to remind us?
Oh, just that it was like, I don't know, that it has more to do with the player piano symbol as a symbol. And I don't know if I'm remembering what I said correctly. And
sounds like it was really memorable.
It was really good and concise. And also the like, that it... how fun and shocking it was to hear something not anachronistic played on that piano. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
I don't know.
I mean, I think that was kind of what I was saying too, but you know, water under the bridge, water under the bridge, Joanna. It's okay.
Let's all agree to disagree about Joplin.
That's right. Okay. So, during the episode last week, I brought up the fact that there were, hundreds of people in the park, like at the gala event. And I said something along the lines of, you know, it feels like the board of Delos is really, really huge. But please, if you're a member of a board of directors, let us know if this is representative. We got this email from Evan, who writes in, hey, David and Joanna, wanted to give you a quick response to your question about why there were so many apparent board members in the park during the massacre. I work closely with the board of directors, and I put on galas not unlike the one portrayed. Larger boards will rarely consist of more than 25 people. As Joanna said, boards will generally bring a plus one. However, galas are often more than a simple celebration and usually have ulterior motives like attracting investors, donors, or customers. Board members will invite as many as 30 people each in order to promote the organization putting on the gala. Contracted partners, media, celebs, and others are likely to be invited as well. For instance, my most recent gala included nearly 300 people in attendance, but the board of directors only consists of about 15 members. Delos's board would probably be a little bit larger. Hope this glimpse into corporate ego stroking has been helpful. Evan. So that comes from Evan, who writes into decodingwestworld@gmail.com. So thanks for that. Yeah, great. Good explanation. And I hope to one day live a life where I am being the one. I am the one inviting 30 people to a gala. That sounds like a good life. But it seems like a very plausible number of people at the gala in Westworld. So just wanted to clear that up. A bunch of people wrote into decodingwestworld@gmail.com to say, you didn't mention Stubbs.
Right.
And what happened to Stubbs. At the end of season one, Stubbs is attacked by people in the park. And then theoretically, like weeks later, in the future timeline that we saw in season two, episode one, Stubbs is breathing comfortably and alive. Right. So I think people just wanted us to acknowledge that at some point in the interim, we will find out how Stubbs survived his whole little tiff with the freaking
ghost
host at the park, right?
Yeah, and I mean, fair point to everyone who's like, why didn't you mention that? That's a fair point. It's not that we didn't like notice, but
people just care a lot about Stubbs, I think, is really what we learned.
This
should be called the Stubbs Show.
The second best Hemsworth, but
third best.
Second best, but I just am assuming we'll find out what happened to him.
Yeah.
There have been some like crazy. Yeah. Oh, someone in our chat has already brought this up. A lot of people think that Stubbs has been swapped out for a host. I'm not on that team, but there are people who think now that Stubbs on the beach is a robot Stubbs. I don't think so, but I have a fairly good, but not entirely perfect track record on this, but he is not pinging my that's a host now radar. So,
All right. We also got a bunch of sort of speculation about what's up with Bernard's brain goo. So this email comes in from Brian. Brian writes in, I think the existence and purpose of the brain goo is related to and inferred from the scene on the beach where the egg is extracted from the Ghost Nation host. The only reason to extract the egg on the beach is to show the audience the liquid surrounding the egg before we see it leaking from Bernard's head. Presumably, the liquid is to cool and cushion the CPU inside the host's heads. If the fluid leaks out, the CPU would overheat and cause corruption of the host brain. Bernard notices he's leaking from the head and wound after the massacre, recognizes the effects because he knows how hosts are built, and performs a self-diagnostic in the lab, refills his brain goo to cool down his CPU. So, Brian, that's Brian writing to decodingwestworld@gmail.com. We also got a bunch of other emails about it. Joanna, any thoughts or any favorite theories of yours?
Are you ready for our first major theory of Westworld Season 2?
Bring it on.
Okay. I'm not sharing every single theory I've read or thought of on this season. A, because some of it is cuckoo bananas. You guys are crazy people. But B, also because some of it is based on images in like the season trailer, and we consider those off limits. So we're not going to talk about this. But this we can anchor entirely to footage that we have all seen on the show. So here it is, which is the multiple Bernards theory. And that is So much is being made about the head wound on Bernard. We know that he's leaking, like his critical failure and the goo that he had to top up and all that sort of stuff is because of this gunshot wound he sustained to his head last season. There is a scar on the side of his forehead that Felix, the tech, sort of like, you know, stitched him up. That's where he got stitched up last season. You see him touching the scar, like much is made of the scar. The camera lingers on it. The character played by Jeffrey Wright, who wakes up on the beach, does not have a scar inside his head. So let's just put that down. And
so what is the theory, Joanna?
Are there multiple Bernards? That's one question. The last thing I'll introduce, and I don't have any.
The great rhetorical question for the ages. Are there multiple Bernards?
Well, this is the last thing I'll say.
Uh-huh.
The last time they fooled us about Bernard.
Yeah.
It was because he was Arnold. So I don't have any solid answers for you. I'm just going to say that, like, there are always two options for who Jeffrey Wright might be playing at any given time. And right. I don't know how it would work for that beach person to be Arnold, but it's always an option for Jeffrey Wright to be playing Arnold instead of Bernard. So,
All right, cool. Well, I think that answers a lot of the emails that we got this week. You can always keep those emails rolling into decodingwestworld@gmail.com. Hey, Joanna. I just thought of a great name for like a great alternate name for this show, which is about how Stubbs messed everything up in the park because he's the security guy.
Yeah,
I think you should call the show Botch It and Stubbs. That's a kind of a Crockett and Tubbs ref. Okay,
yeah, it's really good.
You know, I extemporized it. Okay, you know, improv. I didn't feel a very, very yes and coming out of that, Joanna.
Oh, Miami Nice. Is that our yes and?
Very good. Very good. For our
younger listeners, Crockett and Tubbs were the detectives on Miami Vice.
Oh, right. Thank you. all right. So let's dive into this episode, Joanna. Joanna, crazy shit goes down in this episode. I'm just going to put that out there, right? This episode, Season 2, Episode 2, Reunion, is directed by Vincenzo Natali, previous guest and friend of Decoding Westworld. It was also written by Jonah Nolan, Lisa Joy, and Carly Rae, who is the latter of who's a writer on Mad Men, right?
Yeah.
And it starts with a cold open, right? Am I right about that? Like, it's one of the few episodes in the show to start with a cold open. Because I think most of them don't have a cold open.
I think that's right.
And this is a flashback. Where Arnold and Dolores are talking in an apartment. And I think this is the first glimpse we have of the world outside the park. Am I right about that?
Yeah, because last year everyone was like, has it been decimated by disease? Or like, what's going on in the real world? So yeah, this is our real world look.
Yeah, I do want to call out one thing, which is that last week I made the point like, oh, does it really matter if the park is in Mars? And Peter Serretta from SlashFilm.com gave me a ton of crap about that. He basically said, well, if they're trying to escape the park, then it actually kind of does matter if the park is on Mars, right? Because it would really affect their escape plans, you know, to get to the outside world. So fortunately, you know, we don't even need to deal with me being wrong because we actually see that it's not on Mars in this episode. Kind of.
I mean, let me tell you something.
Yeah.
A few things. Like, because there are still people, even after all the maggots in Dr. Ford's face last week.
Oh, yeah.
There are people who are still like, no, because if Maeve can have MRSA, then a robot Ford can have maggots. I don't know what it's going to take for you people to believe that that is actually Ford dead. But that being said, I think even despite what we saw this week and last, there's still going to be people who are like, but maybe it is on Mars. But you know, the character played by Jeffrey Wright in the scene, probably Arnold. I'm just never sure. But Arnold says that he needs his two worlds to be close to one another. It looks like we're in China. And so
they
to me,
walk by a restaurant with a Chinese character on it. Right.
Right. That Dave's mom helpfully translated for us. So, like, I think that I think that it's I think it's safe to assume, that he's building this home that's a somewhat easy commutable distance from the park so that he can be less of an absentee father and husband to his family is the implication. And that to me seems to confirm the location of the park in the South China Sea somewhere, maybe. Other people will still always say, no, it's right near his rocket launcher pad to the moon or like whatever he wants to. So, yeah.
Yeah. And so I think there's many clues that this is Arnold talking to Dolores, right? First of all, it's like pre-park. Also, young Ford comes in. We hear Anthony Hopkins' voice 80 yard into, you know, this actor's face who we don't really see and is asking about, you know, who is she ready? But Arnold says she's too unpredictable, so they'll go with the other girl instead. You later find out that what they're talking about is how they're going to entice Logan Delos, who we find out his last name is Delos, right?
Mm-hmm.
Logan Delos to invest in this technology, right? And so for all those reasons, we think this is actually Arnold and that we're seeing a flashback in this scene.
Yeah, right? I mean, young Ford is the main indicator there, right?
Yes.
Like he might be cleverly reflected in a window, but that is meant to be young Ford. This does feel like pre-park. They need investors. They need to show something off. I believe other people disagree, but I believe that everything we see here and then in the house that Dolores goes to and then all the stuff with Logan is all the same night. But other people disagree, but or have some questions around it or are at least keeping their minds opened about it. But that's what I believe we're seeing. So
what we're going to do is rather than do the episode scene by scene, we're going to talk about like all the stuff that happens in this timeline or in it's hard to even say this timeline because there's many different moments in time along this path, I guess. Maybe we could say call it what's his name? The guy who plays young William.
The Jimmy Simpson
The Jimmy Simpson timeline, right? Like right. Any time where Jimmy Simpson is alive, like because technically, Joanna, they're all one timeline. You know, they're different points in one timeline. But anyway, the Jimmy Simpson part. But a few other things you write here in the show notes. Arnold says that his wife says he lives in the park and that this is like building it for the house there is for his son Charlie. So we know that Charlie, who was Bernard and Arnold's dying son, is still alive at this point in time.
I rewatched this a bunch of times to like figure out if I felt like Arnold was telling the truth or deluding himself of like, I'm building this for my son Charlie and Charlie's already dead or stuff like that. It really does feel to me like Arnold, and I really do think this is Arnold, believes his son is still alive or his son is still alive when he's talking to Dolores about this. Did you notice the queer pattern on the masonry in his house?
I did. It looked kind of like a maze. We got a few theories on Twitter about what the architecture represented, right?
Okay. And Reddit has been doing its thing because I watched it. I was like, I'm sure this means something. I have no idea what it means. And then Reddit's like, we have some ideas. The maze thing has to do with I don't know if you guys have ever built a maze, drawn a maze, sort of like the thing that Arnold presents to Dolores, but there are these like circuitry patterns that you use to start drawing a maze, and that's similar to one of them that I think it's like a three circuit pattern or something like that they use to start a maze. So basically like you draw that cross pattern and then the four dots and then you draw the lines coming out from the dots like that. Another thing that Reddit found that is crazy has to do with ancient cartography and how that's sign means there's stones at the bottom of this river, which people are trying to connect to like the flood and the lake and the hosts in it and stuff like that. I'm not as convinced of that as I am Arnold, who's fond of mazes, has maze symbology in his house. But
still,
those are two.
Another theory is that what's being shown here is the Jerusalem cube.
Okay, what's that?
Or the Jerusalem cross, which is a major symbol used in Christianity, representing Christ's command to spread the gospel around the world, beginning in Jerusalem. So there's a lot of different theories, about what this could be. Actually, this theory I'm reading about this Jerusalem cube is at a website called religionandpopularculture.com, and you are name-checked on this article. speculating about the Jerusalem cube. So anyway, a lot of different theories about what this could mean, but I think the show clearly draws your attention to it with a close up, right? It wouldn't, I don't think it would do that unless it was somehow significant.
Yeah. And someone in the chat mentions that it's the Ennis house, which is a Los Feliz house. It's similar to, but not the same pattern as the Ennis house, which you can Google if you want to. So it's similar, though, like it's probably a reference to, but it's not the same pattern as. So but Marina Midori in the chat brings up a great question, which I actually don't have an answer for, which is if this all takes place in one night. Right. So if we see Arnold and Ford and Dolores talking and Arnold saying she's not ready, and then we see Arnold taking Dolores to a house, and then we see later see Angela pitching Logan. How is it that Arnold, like, Dolores is basically like, wow, this is a sweet ass house. I'm going to paraphrase Dolores there. And yeah, Arnold's like, Arnold's
it sounded
like,
just like her. Yeah.
Thank you. Yeah. And Arnold's like, oh, I've been lucky. Right. Which sounds like he has a lot of money. And so a lot of people have questioned, including Marina in our chat, of like, what, if Arnold and Ford are so desperate for investors, how does Arnold have all this money already to build this sweet ass house?
Right.
I don't have a good answer for that. So.
I don't know. That doesn't bother me at all. I mean, like, there are plenty of people who are doing okay or decently financially who are part of startups, but whose startups are running out of money. So I guess I've seen that enough in real life that it doesn't feel out of the realm of possibility.
I agree with that. I just want to put a pin in it, like, because some people are saying this is indication of like hinky timeline, whatever it might be. You never know with Westworld, but I agree with you, Dave. My first instinct was I know plenty of rich people in the Bay Area whose startup like doesn't have money, but they have money to buy a nice house. So, yeah.
So then Logan and William, we see Logan and William, which, you know, I know, I think you had an inkling that we'd see them again. I did not really know that we would have, you know, meaningful interactions with these two again. And this is pre-Westworld season one, right? This interaction we're seeing. Because Logan says at some point, can you believe that guy's dating my sister? So it's before they were even engaged, right? So it's could be months or years before Westworld season, the events of Westworld season one.
I believe it's years because Arnold killed himself multiple years, like something that Logan says in season one indicates that Arnold killed himself several years ago.
Right.
So Arnold killed himself 35 years ago. Logan and William go to the park 30 years ago. So like roughly 5 years, roughly.
Yeah. I mean, not to mention the park doesn't exist at this point in time.
Right.
So it's like, it's no matter how futuristic their technology is, it's going to take some time to build that park. So they're talking to this Asian dude, and then, you know, William gets bored and leaves, and Logan kind of makes a pass at the dude to kind of remind you that he's bisexual, I believe, right? And then...
Trust me, I hadn't forgotten. Thanks, Logan.
And then Angela and Kichita?
Kichita.
Mm-hmm. Played by Zan McLarnon, walk in.
It's Zahn.
Zahn McLaren. Thank you.
Yeah.
A preview of all the names we're going to butcher today. So they talk like they basically represent the Argos Initiative, and they're here to present Logan with technology that he may or may not want to invest in. Right? What does Argos mean to you, Joanna?
Gosh, so many things. But first of all, let's really quickly note the music that's playing here, which is the Kanye West track that we knew was coming because it also played over a trailer, right, for season two. A Ramin Djawadi-esque piano cover of Kanye's Runaway, right? A lot of people noted that this was a interesting week for a Kanye West song to drop in an episode of television, given what Kanye has been up to on Twitter. And when it plays, Logan says, toast to the assholes.
Yeah.
So some people just found that a humorous coincidence.
Which is a line from the song, we should say. So
yeah. So, But the Argos Initiative. Someone today pointed out to me, and I hadn't realized that Argos Initiative, the initials for which are AI. But this is the first we've heard of this. This is what the company was called before it was Delos Incorporated. Argos Initiative is what Ford and Arnold called their company. with the use of Delos and Argos, I feel like we need to really keep diving into our knowledge of Greek mythology and Greek history. Argos makes me think of Jason and the Argonauts. Argos makes me think of the Maze and the Minotaur. And then the Argos contingent was also involved in the Battle of Troy, which of course is a Trojan horse, which I think we're probably going to see some kind of Trojan horse situation this season, based on, like, I don't know, hosts playing possum, perhaps, would be my thoughts on Argos. What does it mean to... Oh, and the last one someone mentioned to me is there's a giant named Argos, I think it is, that's covered in all covered in eyes. And this is like the origin myth for the peacock, I believe. It was like guarding the tree with the apple of discord, I think it is, in Greek mythology. Someone mentioned it as a possibility of like, this company's always watching you. The eyes are always open. So, yeah.
Very cool. A lot of potential meanings to chew on there. So we see Logan going into this room. He says that his father leaves all the prospecting to him. He goes into this room, and there's a bunch of people there, and like he thinks it's a game where he needs to tell who the one hidden host was. Now, when you were watching this, was your reaction, they're all hosts, which was what my reaction was, or what did you think of it?
Yeah, but like that's because Jonathan Tucker's in the scene, right?
Yeah.
Actor Jonathan Tucker really gave the game away for me. Plus, we know Angela is a host. Plus, I was pretty sure Zahn McLaren, who's so good on Fargo season 2. I'm pretty sure he's also playing. Well, I know now, but I was pretty sure he was also playing a host. So I knew right away. Jonathan Tucker's a real giveaway, maybe for some people who like his work. But yeah.
So Jonathan Tucker plays Major Craddock, who appears later in the episode. But have we seen him prior to this point? In the Westworld?
No, but in the casting announcement for season 2, they said he was playing someone named Major Craddock.
I see.
And I was I don't think Major Craddock is the name of a guy at a fancy party.
So then Logan has a orgy with a bunch of the hosts. And then Dolores watches as Angela gets dressed. So a couple things. First of all, as you write in the show notes, Clementine is playing The Man I Love by Gershwin. And that was really cool to see, like, because the reveal of Clementine, you see her from behind, and then later you see her it's Clementine playing the piano there. Mm-hmm. Kind of cool. Why was Dolores even there? That was my question. Was that explained?
Well, I think Dolores was just like nearby because Dolores was going to be used, and then they used Angela instead. I don't know why Dolores then like wandered into the party.
Yeah, why did she like get into his hotel room? Like that was what was confusing to me, but you know.
I don't know.
Yeah.
I don't know the answer to that. To me, it looked a little bit like, I mean, this is the thing is like Ford said in season 1, we're not supposed to lay emotion on them, but it looked to me like Dolores was looking a little judgmentally at Angela, and it looked to me as Angela was getting dressed that she looked a little like defensive and ashamed. Mm. Those are the like facial expressions I read on those actresses.
Okay, let me just say for the record that was not what I read. I mean, okay. I thought it was kind of like Dolores was kind of for Dolores is like seeing her parents, you know, have sex or something. It was like this discovery. This element of like what is happening, and I'm only beginning to scratch the surface of how hosts are deployed, right? And like what we are, what our usages are, and how humans will subjugate us. Like that's kind of it cuts back and forth between modern day Dolores like wreaking havoc, and then this kind of older innocent Dolores. And so I think this is kind of part of the loss of her innocence, or her innocence starting to be peeled away. That's my interpretation.
Yeah, that's a really good one. We should also mention. That's something we lose by doing this sort of somewhat chronologically or whatever, is the smash cut from this to Angela stabbing a dude in the modern timeline. This is the part I'm just saying it everywhere I can so that whoever it is that I said this to hears me. This is the part where I admit I was wrong, because on Twitter, when the trailer came out, I thought that was Dolores, like, putting her bra on, getting dressed. And a bunch of people were like, I think that looks like Tallulah Riley, the actress who plays Angela. And I'm like, no, it's Dolores. And I was, like, real shitty about it. So I was wrong. And I want to apologize to those people. And when I saw the episode, I was like, oh, no.
All right. Anyway. Well, hopefully they'll accept your apology. But let's move on with the rest of the episode here. So we're still kind of staying with this William and Logan storyline, and we cut to the inside of the park and the beginning of Dolores' loop, where Armistice is a sheriff. Dolores drops her can, Teddy approaches, and then everything freezes. Great moment again. Reminds me of like how fun that opening episode of Westworld was, where you thought Teddy was a guest. You
know, right.
Like the whole opening episode is shot as a Teddy's the guest, but then you realize he's actually part of the game. And this kind of brought me back to that. Everything freezes, and then here we have a Peter, I want to say Mullen?
Yeah.
Peter Mullen.
Peter Mullen.
A.K.A. Jim Delos, A.K.A. Logan's dad, comes over. He picks up the milk can, and then they have an interaction about the park. And William is trying to convince Jim Delos to invest in Westworld.
So to be clear, Delos already has a stake in Westworld,
right.
And William wants like a controlling.
That's right. No, I'm sorry. You're right. They've already because this is after the events of this is after the events of William or young William in season one of Westworld, right? So William has already gone through his whole adventure with Logan and with Dolores, and he is trying to say, "Hey, we gotta like I'm gonna kick in more money, and I'm gonna like control this." And he's basically doing like a hostile takeover, essentially, right?
Yes, actually, yes. And I wanted to pause really quickly and ask you, like, are you a fan or familiar with the actor Peter Mullen? Do you have any like feelings about him?
I've seen him in things, and I think he's really talented.
Okay.
But yeah, I mean, he was in like Children of Men. He was in Braveheart. Great roles in those movies.
I'm a huge fan of both his and Jonathan Tucker, and so like the additions this season, I just think have been and Zahn McLaren. So the additions, whoever's casting this, and I should have looked this up, and it's probably Nina Gold since I like everything, but
since
maybe
she casts
not
everything. Yeah,
is just so top notch, and I'm so excited that Peter Mullen's a part of this season for however long he may be. But so William wants to stage a hostile takeover, as you put it, and his pitch to Jim Delos is like, you know, Jim is saying a similar thing that Logan was saying in season one, which is that the company's in financial dire straits. They're hemorrhaging cash. They've got like 2 or 3 years at best before they go under because their business model cannot sustain or whatever. And he's like, I don't want to invest in this like money loser of a pleasure park. And then this is where William delivers like his, this is why I think it's important that Carly Rae from Mad Men wrote this episode. This is where he delivers his pitch about like what the park can really mean, how it can deliver to them like unfiltered marketing research, because people think what happens in Westworld stays in Westworld, but they're going to be watching everything. I think it's a great scene and a great glimpse of the, I'm liking this evolution of William that we see.
Yeah. Oh, totally. Really, really enjoy seeing him go from. I mean, there's really this crazy arc that he goes on from doe-eyed, naive person, you know, being enticed by the charms of Westworld, to then realizing how he can turn that to his business advantage, right, is what we see in this episode.
Yeah, and I didn't really like the cut we got in the season finale last year of, like, he puts on the hat and then he lifts up his head and it's Ed Harris, and I'm like, but then what?
Lived an entire lifetime between those two cuts, I think, or that cut is what we're is what we're saying.
And the interview with – I had an interview with Jimmy Simpson last year where he's like, no, I'm not going to be back for season two. I think either A, he was lying, or B, he didn't know yet. Or I should say 2 years ago, whenever this season one came out. And I was like, really? We're not going to get like more young William and like how the F he got here? And I'm just – I actually really, really like this episode for all of that stuff.
Yeah. Overall, I thought it was a great episode. It is truly horrifying to imagine the idea of a massive multinational – corporation worth billions of dollars, where they've aggregated all this user data that they can use against you. I mean, it's really horrifying to even contemplate that being a possibility, and I hope it never comes to pass in the real world. You know what I mean?
I don't know. Yeah, I don't know what you're talking about.
I'm talking about a fictional imagined future and not the reality that we exist in on a day-to-day basis, you know?
Actually, someone, I mean, I'll circle back to this at the end of the episode, but someone mentioned not just, I'm going to say that was a Facebook illusion, but you can deny if you want.
I was actually talking about Friendster, but okay, go ahead.
Okay, sure. MySpace? I don't know. Not just the Facebook comparison in this episode, but also the idea that Dolores is in all, like, Jimmy Simpson is in a lot of these scenes. Dolores is in all of these scenes. Not just because she's a character we're following, but because, as we've seen on the show before, hosts can be in scenes in order to spy for their masters. Right. As we saw with Rodrigo Santoro's character last year, Hector, spying on Charlotte and Teresa. So just to know that Dolores could be recording every single thing that William and Jim and Logan say throughout this episode and spitting it back to Ford or whomever.
Right. Likely is, I would say. Or at the very least, she's retaining it.
You're right. This place is a fantasy. Nothing here is real except one thing. The guests. Half of your marketing budget goes to trying to figure out what people want. Because they don't know. But here they're free. Nobody's watching. Nobody's judging. At least that's what we tell them. This is the only place in the world where you get to see people for who they really are. And if you don't see the business in that, then you're not the businessman that I thought you were. You're the cheeky little cunt, aren't you? There's not a man alive who'd talk to me like that. Not anymore.
There is a party at Della's mansion, and we see a number of hosts in the white intake dresses. Dolores is playing the piano, which is cool. Chopin Nocturne, very beautiful. We see William with his wife, Juliet, and apparently they hired the actress that was in the photo from season one, is my understanding, right? So she didn't even, as far as I understand, she didn't even know that she was in season one in the photo, right? Because didn't they get it off like a stock photo website or something like that?
So there's a big mystery around this now. But when we last discussed this photo, this is our understanding. This is a stock photo that they found, and the woman in the photo just happened to be Claire Onavia, who is a woman who won Cycle 10 of America's Next Top Model, or lost Cycle 10 of America's Next Top Model. And so I thought it was really cute that they and she didn't know that they used her photo until the season aired and stuff like that. And so I thought it was really cute that they tracked her down and got her to appear as Juliet Delos in this episode. But if you want to go on Huffington Post, I don't usually ascribe to this level of crackpottery, but there's something really weird going on with the photo that Huffington Post tried to get HBO to comment about. The guy, the model is saying it was never a stock photo to begin with. The guy whose photo stream that it was is hosted on has a bunch of samurai and cowboy photos on his photo stream. So this might all be once again, another weird Jonathan Nolan prank. I don't know what to tell you, but right.
It could be a misdirect of some kind. Basically.
It could, but I don't fully buy into it, but I would recommend you go to this, read this Huffington Post, because they interviewed the model. And she talked about that, and I don't know. There's some question marks. At first, it sounded like Reddit crackpottitude to me. Then I read the article, and I was a little convinced that something slightly fishy is going on. But point being, this is Juliet, who appeared in the photo in season one. They've got a kid, Emily, so we can sort of anchor it in the timeline that way. It's been at least, I don't know, Emily looks five or six. It's at least been that long since they got married, if not a little longer. So we know how far we've progressed, and we're at Jim Delos's enforced retirement party. So.
Yes. But Joanna, I mean, what I think is very clear from this scene is that, you know, the mind eggs, the idea it's going to be introduced soon, I'm sure, is the idea that you can upload consciousness to these mind eggs, right? And that they can be switched around.
Is that clear to you from this scene?
It is as clear to me as any of your theories are to you. And I say that because Delos says, quote, "This is a retirement party? I couldn't tell. Looks more like a coronation, but no mind. Our arrangement's been a perfect fit. Your stepping down doesn't help me at all, nor me." And then he says, "And I was told I might not have to."
Yeah.
And then William says, "Things are progressing, but we'll all need a little patience." So the idea is that, like, Jim Delos is dying, and he might not have to step down. And then Jimmy Simpson says, like, things are progressing. Things are progressing in terms of uploading consciousnesses to the.
No, see, okay. So I 1,000% agree with you on the first level of interpretation. I'm not disagreeing with the whole thing, but I'm saying leaping to definitely consciousnesses are going to be uploaded to mind eggs. I'm not saying it's wrong. I'm saying it's a slight leap that people are taking. And what is also true is that we found out in season one that, like, the Delos Incorporation, when it's not running Westworld, like, does a lot of advancement in certain things. And Anthony Hopkins' character said in season one, like, we can cure any illness. We've done all this, blah, blah, blah. So whatever. So Jim Delos is dying, and whatever they're working on at Delos, maybe uploading consciousness to a mind egg, maybe something else.
Maybe a cure for cancer.
A cure for cancer, which Anthony Hopkins says has been cured by season two.
Yeah.
Made him hope that whatever is ailing him right now would be cured and he would not have to step down.
All right.
But the uploading consciousness to a mind egg, once again, not saying it's wrong. I'm just saying it's a leap that people are taking.
We
right?
just sound like complete insane people when talking about this show.
It's true.
The uploading consciousness is a mind egg. I'm not saying that's wrong. It's probably correct. Later, so then they have a party, right? And like Logan talks about
I think it's the same party, right?
It's the
later
party.
That
it's like
night.
The
yeah.
Same party
yeah.
at night. And he's injecting like future heroin into his arm, right?
Yeah.
Futurist Delos heroin into his arm.
Sure.
And he says, "Do you want to know what they're really celebrating up there? That, darling, is the sound of fools fiddling while the whole fucking species starts to burn. And the funniest fucking part is they lit the match." What'd you make of that, Joanna Robinson? Any thoughts on that?
Well, okay, so here's the part where I would be like, well, maybe we are talking about digital immortality, because the rest of that quote is, "So here's to you assholes, may your forever be blissfully short." So, like, the forever sounds to me like some sort of digital immortality, right? So, like, that could be, and this is a theory we talked about last season about, like, uploading your consciousness to a digital, putting yourself in a host or something like that. You know, so I feel like Logan obviously has, okay, let me rewind. William has obviously delivered on his promise, which was to disgrace Logan in his own company, in his father's eyes, and all this sort of stuff, right?
Yeah.
Logan, who was always dissipated, is now a complete wreck of a human being, seemingly addicted to Delos heroin or whatever it is. And he's very embittered about whatever it is they are doing that is not everything to do with Westworld. Whatever this is, he thinks is going to be the end of humanity. And if that means, like, putting humankind into a robot, it's not a bad theory. But that's my interpretation of what Logan is saying. Mm.
Fair enough. Later on, we see William and talking to...
One last music cue is just that we get a loop back to what Clementine was playing at the beginning, the other party, which is the Gershwin, "The Man I Love." Those lyrics are, like, really, really knife twisty. If you're young William and you have a fondness for Gershwin, because, you know, it's a lot of what Dolores said in the season one finale I think it's the second to last episode of season one, when she's talking to old William. She's like, "There's a man coming and he's going to fix you. And he's the man I love. He's William and he's great and he's coming." And then Ed Harris is like, "You dumb blonde. I'm William, you dummy." But, like, the sentiment of those lyrics really, I think, have a lot of meaning for the William Dolores relationship, which some people are still, like, feeling really poignant in Romeo and Juliet-y about. And I'm just so off of William entirely that I don't feel that way. Mm. And this scene that you're about to talk about is one of the reasons why.
Which scene specifically? Well, he's kind of interrogating her in one of those diagnostic rooms. And he's like, "I can't believe I fell in love with you." This is basically him kind of casting off his past, right, and saying, like, forging on into the future of this enterprise that he's about to embark on, and saying, like, I once was young and stupid, and now I'm not anymore. Like, the scales have fallen from my eyes.
Do you believe him?
Well, I think his obsession got transferred to something else, right? His obsession got transferred to finding out how Ford built the park, and now this door that he needs to get out of. So his tendency for obsession continued, but I do think that, yeah, he the whole focus of season one was about how the Man in Black was no longer taken with the park's charms, you know, and that he's digging for something deeper. And so I do think we're seeing the origin of that.
I agree and disagree in that I think it's still all about Dolores, and always is going to be about Dolores for him, because the whole quest for the park is to Ed Harris, as old William, his stated purpose in the park is to awake consciousness, enact like freedom of choice for these hosts. And I believe that the reason that he wants to do that is to find out that if Dolores has a choice, if she would choose him. That's my interpretation of what, like, he's actually driven by. So when he's like, you're nothing, you're a thing, you're just a reflection of me, all this stuff, like, this is some very Don Draper shit, to be honest with you. But, like, it's I think it's self-deluding. And I also want to say that in terms of, like, this is, like, the ultimate revenge porn of, like, revenge porn being if a woman has spurned you, you put naked photos or sex tape of her on the internet or whatever. Like, William taking this woman who has spurned him and stripping her down in, I mean, we see him do terrible things her in season one, but, like, it's just the her naked in the room and him abusing her is, like, I'm not angry. I think it's tremendously good storytelling, and it's, like, really revolting. I mean, William Caesar is trying to see her as a thing. I don't think he actually does. Mm. But in terms of, like, a parallel for, I don't know, that's what struck me anyway.
So we skipped over one thing earlier on in this episode. When Dolores first wakes up, she says, it looks like the stars have been scattered across the ground. Have you ever seen anything so full of splendor? Right? She says that to Arnold. Later on, she repeats that exact same phrase again, and Arnold kind of, like, snaps out of this trance that he's in. He realizes that she's a machine, right?
Yeah.
And then at the end of this episode, so this takes place after the first scene when he says, have you ever seen anything so full of splendor, right?
Yeah.
Why do we think William knows that phrase? Did he get it from her?
You know, I'm sure she says it in the park too.
Yeah, so she,
like,
she,
it's on her loop.
It's on her loop. So he just is repeating it back to her. Is the theory right?
Yeah, yeah.
And then we see a bunch of Earth movers kind of terraforming things, and then we see the result of that decades later in a later scene, right? When there's, like, a town there, it appears, right? And some kind of weapon that is alluded to. So
I don't think that's. I think that's too literal an interpretation.
Oh, well, I mean, I have thoughts on what the weapon is, but we can.
Well,
we can...
I think that William is just saying, I think, I don't know. No one has matched up the basis for me convincingly, but I think this is just William showing her either he's building something there. Specifically, I don't think it's necessarily that town that she's looking at, or this is just like, look how big the scope of this park is going to be. We're building. Look what we can build here. Do you know what I mean?
My interpretation was that it's the same area. So I guess we'll find out.
And then the other thing I wanted to ask you before we roll away from Jimmy Simpson is I feel like he's doing a bit more this season, like trying to do, as they age him up, a bit more of an Ed Harris impression, specifically sort of how he holds his mouth. Hmm. I don't know if you thought that that was the case.
No, I have not noticed, but I'll look out for that next week. So,
okay.
Yeah. All right. Well, that's the William storyline from the past. Any other thoughts before we move on to the other storylines this week?
I don't think so.
Okay. Well, before we move on, this podcast is possible because a few hundred people decided to contribute money to our Kickstarter. All, you know, tens of thousands of you can enjoy the show because of these awesome souls who decided to contribute to this and make this show possible. And we want to thank some of them tonight. So I'd like to thank some of them. Etienne, Vijay Varman, Kip Palalis, Matthew Punamalli, Mike Brown, John Maxwell, Mike Vecchio, Alec Bernal, Rosemary, Broderick Gordas, Taylor Gailey, Vicky Peterson, Mark Rodriguez of the House Rodriguez. It's supposed to be pronounced in Oberyn Martell style accent. That's pretty
oh my
bad.
God, I just almost had a stroke. It's so funny.
It's pretty rough.
Good.
Pretty
good.
Rough.
No, it's good. It's really good.
Randy French, Chris Howard, and Sean Welsh. Thanks so much for your contributions. Really appreciate it. Joanna, I think you have some people to thank too, right?
Oh my God, it's Shen. All right. Yeah, I want to start by thanking Mattis Knopf, Jonathan Ludwig, Ryan H., Trey Smith, Joshua O'Connor, Babbling Stacy, Stephanie Deal, Paul Stella, Michael Doyle, Jim Nardakia, Lisa Hawthorne, Joey Bright, Mazer Leschwip, I think.
That's pretty good.
Kyan Taylor. Oh, no, sorry, Kevin Taylor. I don't know why I just, like, made up a name. Kevin Taylor, Roland Calusa, Ross Luck, John B., Alexander Francis Elms, sung to the tune of Alexander Hamilton was
nice.
The request.
Good.
And Matthias. So thank you guys all so much.
Really appreciate it. And yeah, it's been really fun to kind of, it's great to be able to have this forum to talk out the episode with, because at the end of that episode, I'm like, it is, you know, it's hard to keep up with this show. And so I'm glad we have this forum to kind of try and keep up with it. So let's talk about present Dolores. Here you write, distraught asshole guest in a tux from last episode breaks into Della's basement. The techs don't know what's going on, saying they've been on for 13 hours, like they've been on their shift for a really long time. They're then told that the hosts are rebelling. Again, over and over again, it seems like the security in this park is truly horrible and that no one even anticipated that something like this might happen. But anyway, Dolores, Angela, Teddy, they all roll in. Angela shoots one of the Della's employees. Dolores menaces Adela's board member, and she says, "No one is here to judge what we will do to you." And she says, "I know exactly what's out in your world," and it flashes back to the other stuff that she saw in the rest of this episode. So, you know, they kind of torture these dudes. They torture one of the dudes for information about how Delos may attempt to retake the park. And Teddy's just kind of finding out all this stuff at once. He's freaking out. He grabs one of the techs. He's screaming, why do you do this? What the hell is this place? And you imagine trying to explain that to someone, like why they would simulate this place and just torture them for fun. And Dolores tries to communicate that. Okay, I'm going to pause here. Any thoughts on this whole sequence of Dolores kind of terrorizing the techs and the guests and all this stuff? I mean, I think last week we were talking about how it's not super interesting just because it's kind of a one-note performance.
It is.
Just this version of the character. I think Evan Rachel Wood is phenomenal overall on the show. But just this you know, she's not tortured. She's not – you don't even – like, she's just a person on a mission and – and that's it. Like, there's nothing. There's no nuance.
There's no internal conflict around it and stuff like that. Yeah, I find it very boring. But Teddy, seeing all the times he died, feels like a nice little callback to season one and all the times that James Morrison's character had to die in season one. Some stuff like the cutting back and forth between Angela as like this sort of sex object being presented to lure people in, and Angela is this like avenging angel. The shoving the tech's head, or like whatever the guy is, into like the white goo that they use to make the hosts, I thought was really interesting. First of all, I like never thought about how hot that goo must be,
right?
Until you hear it like sizzling on some guy's face. And then just the reverse of all the times we saw the host faces emerge from like a pool of white goo versus them shoving like a guy's head into the white goo, I thought was like a nice tidy reversal. But all the stuff that Dolores says, I mean, it's just reiterating of the same thing, which is like, you guys used us. We're here to use you. She gets a lay of the land. She finds out what the protocol is, how many men they're going to send, how many men she might need to defend herself. She sees a map, the rallying point, which kind of looks like the beach where we opened the season a bit, all that sort of stuff. But in terms of like, am I excited to hang out with Dolores in this mode? No. Even though agree she has every right to be as ticked as she's ticked, you know.
There is this great close-up of the board member's face and, like, tears running down his face, and I think Dolores, like, presses a knife up against it or something like that, if I recall correctly. But I just felt like, oh, you know, Vincenzo Natali directed this episode. He's a very talented horror film director. And I felt like, oh, that's probably Vincenzo Natali is probably, you know, it's hard to tell directorial or authorial intent in these episodes, but I felt like that might have been a Vincenzo Natali touch there. And I thought it was, like the rest of the episode, very beautiful. Agreed with everything you said about, like, that the scene is pretty interesting, except for what Dolores is doing here. But anyway, she decides to, try and, like, get out of the park. Am I right about this? Right? Like, that's what they're trying to do.
She doesn't say that specifically. We can assume that that's what she wants to do. And she knows she needs men. And by men, I mean, you know, she bodies in order to do that. Yeah. And so they resurrect one of the Confederados that they find in this. It's like a remote repair station. And so, yeah, if you want to talk about Vincenzo Natale's knack for horror, this guy looks awful.
He looks like not in a good state. And so then she has an interaction with Maeve and Hector and Sizemore. As they're kind of crossing different paths, like Maeve is trying to, she just wants to find her kids in Tom Jane voice, right? Like, she's just like trying to get her kid, whereas Dolores is out for blood. And so they have this really interesting conversation that many have interpreted as an interaction between, you know, white feminism and non-white feminism, or like intersectionality. What were your thoughts on that scene, Joanna?
Yeah, and I want to give a shout out to Kim Renfro from Business Insider, who I think sort of originated this conversation. It's not something that had occurred to me when I watched the episode. And here's the deal. I'm not sure that was the intent, but I'm not sure that matters, because I think this is a really good kind of conversation to have around Westworld, because I think so often we get bogged down in, like, mind eggs and brain goo and, like, where are we and when are we? So, you know, like, we get so caught up in, like, trying to orient ourselves in Westworld that stuff like, hey, is this a commentary on white feminism, I think is a great pause and conversation to have. Like I said, I don't know if that was the intent, but I think it works really, really well in this scene. Not wanting to, like, I think we should define, maybe for people who don't live on Twitter, like, what white feminism means, which is not just like all white women who are feminists, but the kind of feminism espoused by some white women about that doesn't really care for anyone other than themselves, like, doesn't take into account how further marginalized communities might feel about certain things. And so this conversation that Maeve and Dolores have, which is Dolores being like, my way is the right way, as played by white actress Evan Rachel Wood, and Maeve saying, well, you want everyone to be free, does that mean that everyone gets to choose what that means for themselves? And you seem very hell-bent on, like, directing what freedom means for everyone. And so I don't know, I thought it was an interesting interpretation. I really like it, and I like thinking about the show that way.
Yeah, the quote that Maeve says is, revenge is just a different prayer at their altar, darling, and yeah. I'm well off my knees. And so I think the idea is that Dolores is somehow playing into their game by being extremely militant about wanting to kill everyone and take over the park. That is simply another form of subjugation, right? I think is what she's arguing, is what Maeve is arguing, is that, like, what Dolores is doing is you're not truly free. You're just enslaved in a different way than you did, that you don't recognize, right?
Right.
And that merely trying to kill everyone creates its own form of slavery, and that Maeve is just not interested in that at all.
And I think we're inclined to agree with Maeve in this scene simply because she's not going around and, like, killing other hosts and stuff like that. In fact, she's being very tender to me, even more than
about all the hosts that she was responsible for, or not the hosts, but the people deaths she was responsible for in season one, though, right?
I mean, they had it coming, maybe. anyway, for me, what this episode starts to deal with, and I will be interested to watch it more closely with you this season. And I'm really happy that I'm doing this podcast with you, because you are raised and are a practicing Christian. And as you know, I am a heathen and an atheist, but I am an English major. And so that means that Christian ideology or symbology, really always sticks out to me. So we have so much Messiah complex stuff going on in this episode. Dolores sees herself, has crowned herself. Angela is the one who's literally crowned herself with some thorns, but Dolores has crowned herself like the chosen Messiah. She claims to have killed God. That's not what the Messiah ever claimed to do, but she feels like she should be the one to lead the people. And I'm wondering if you want to look at Maeve as an alternate example of what a Messiah figure should do. Mm-hmm. We see her administering tender mercy to a host in episode one. And so I see them as two options of maybe multiple options. Maybe there are more this season of a leader. And if you want to say a Messiah, you know, so that was sort of my interpretation of this scene.
Got it. Also, we got to call out Sizemore looks amazing in this scene, right?
I mean,
he just is his cowboy outfit is awesome.
His burro and his hat. Yeah. And then I see, you know, you've got Maeve and Dolores, and then you've got their sidekicks in Teddy and Hector. They're like lovesick boyfriends who will do anything for them. So, yeah.
Dolores has this scene where she kind of owns all these dudes and then kills them, but then revives them, right, using the little Westworld tablet. And I actually talked about this last week. I thought to my I commented, why is it that these hosts, I guess what this show is positing is that there's two layers of programming, right? There's the way I would compare it is there's the firmware of the iPod, and then there's the songs that go on it, right? And so there's this there's this layer of how the hosts behave, but then underneath that they're kind of the rules under which they exist. So the hosts are clearly in open rebellion, but they also die when they're shot. But they're robots, so they don't need to die when they're shot. They could theoretically keep functioning as long as their insides work. And I think we see that there is a separate layer of programming that they can be revived and they can counteract their quote-unquote firmware or their hard-coded programming of dying, right?
Right.
That was my interpretation. Does that make sense to you?
Sure.
Yeah. So then they go down to this encampment where Dolores is going to go get this weapon. And she's going to use this weapon to turn against the humans. So I think this is a good point where we can speculate a little bit about what we think this weapon is, right? And I think neither of us think it's an actual weapon, it's an actual gun or something like that. Am I right in saying that?
Right.
Because Westworld is too tricky for that, right?
Right.
I've seen a lot of people speculate that it could be all the data that they could use to blackmail people, or the data that could use to replace people, replace individuals in the real world, replacing, powerful people like the president or something like that. What's your favorite theory about what the weapon is, Joanna?
Let's see. Someone suggested to me it might be a virus that wipes out all of humanity, but the hosts are safe. I don't think we have any sort of precedent for that, so I'm not sure about that one. Some people think it's something. It's something that I think it's worth saying, but in this episode, several men show Dolores something, whether actively or passively. So I believe it's something that we saw in this episode shown to Dolores, and I don't think it's those Earth Movers that, the episode cuts to the Earth Movers, so you think that that's what he's talking about, or cut from them. So you think that maybe that's what she's talking about, but I think it's something showed them the frailty of humanity, showed them the thing you said about uploading consciousness to mind eggs or whatever it is, shown them something, shown some frailty in humanity. Maybe it's Logan that showed her something. Maybe it's Jim Delos. Maybe it's William. Maybe it's Arnold. But some person who she sort of snarkily calls a friend showed her something in this episode that she feels is the key to undoing of humanity.
Do we think this is the place where future William is also heading? The Man in Black is also heading?
Yeah.
He says, this place, I built it, and this place we're going is my greatest mistake, he says. And I think it cuts to that scene, with the Earth Movers, or that area, and I feel like they're implying that that's the same location. That was my impression?
I think I don't know about same location, but maybe. But I do like the idea. I'll say this much. I do like the idea of this season being a race that everyone is headed to the same place. And the reason that you think that is like to lean back into sort of like the religious, themes of the season, they keep referring to this as the valley beyond, the pearly gates, blah, blah, blah. Like they keep referring, like in both storylines, in both the old Williams storyline with Lawrence, who we should talk about at some point, and in all the Dolores stuff, they keep referring to this place that is heaven, but not a literal heaven. And so I like that I feel like they're both going to the same place. But the place is not the point, seems to be the message there. I do want to really quickly loop back to the Jesus stuff and say that when Dolores walks in and sees Jonathan Tucker back in the episode as the major Craddock character, the way he seated all of his guys on one side of the table, that to me looks like a very classic Last Supper setup, even though I don't think we're meant to see Craddock as a Messiah figure. And then Dolores resurrecting him once again, another resurrection, like feels like, you know, an act of Jesus, stuff like that. I'm not saying like, and I hope this is not offensive to say this, like to you or to any of our listeners, like who are Christian, who are listening. I don't mean to use it flippantly. I just think that the TV show is definitely trying to draw a little parallel here. But mostly in Dolores' mind. She fancies herself this way. I don't think we're supposed to sort of see her as a positive Jesus figure, but like as someone who has a Messiah complex that's run amok. So is my interpretation after these two episodes. But
got it. All right. Well, only a few other events to talk about with The Man in Black. We see the return of Lawrence, played by Clifton Collins Jr. The Man in Black comes and rescues him. I like this whole idea of, you know, the Man in Black says, hey, typically you'd get yourself out of this situation, but it looks like the programming has, like, taken things a little too far. You know, I like this idea that, oh, like, they're kind of still on their loops, but maybe a variation of them. You know what I'm saying? I thought it was a really fascinating concept.
I think William says, like, this is what happens when a story loop is played to its, like, logical conclusion or something, you know, like, without any checks in it. But if you're a Westworld obsessive or recently rewatched season one a couple times like I did, all of the callbacks and Lawrence stuff is insane. Like, it's just so many, like, he's hanging from a rope, like, he's got a rope around him when the Man in Black first comes to meet him in season one. He rescues him. The rescue in season one goes perfectly well because the Man in Black in season one can shoot everyone with no reprisal. Doesn't go as well in season two. We also have to remember that the last time Ed Harris saw Lawrence, he had strung him up on a tree and drained him of blood. So like all of that stuff tracks. There's just like so many callbacks for this Lawrence stuff. Obviously, Pariah stuff that we'll get to, but like even the establishing shot of them on the way to Pariah, which is a bell hanging over a cross, is the same establishing shot though done in daytime that we saw in season one. So to me, that's not just like chase your own tail minutia, but it's a commentary, as you say, sort of on like the looping nature of the park.
The cyclical nature. Yeah.
The cyclical nature and how easy it is for William to find things because he knows how all the loops operate. Right.
Right. And the quote, by the way, is, I guess the Pardue brothers aren't as easy to kill when they're off the leash, I think is what he says.
He does say that, but it's not the Pardue brothers that are stringing him up. When we meet him in season one, he's being strung up for killing the Pardue brothers. So Lawrence killed the Pardue brothers to get himself out of that anthill situation. And then William rescues him from being hung for shooting the Pardue brothers.
Yeah, for the crime, yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
So, you know, William takes him to this bar and kind of explains what is going on with the park and, you know, alludes to the true purpose of the park in vague terms. And then they are headed to the Pearly Gates. Is I guess how they're referring to the destination, which I think for William, the Pearly Gates, that is the same as the door that William is heading for. Is that right? Do we think that's the same thing or
maybe, but he doesn't, I don't think he knows what the door is.
Right. No, yet. I agree. He doesn't know what the door is.
Yeah.
So they head over, and they need to go through Pariah. They go to Pariah and they meet El Lazo, which is a character that was referenced in season one, but we never met. Am I right about that?
Incorrect. Character played by Clifton Collins Jr. in season one in the young William storyline.
That's right. That's right. That's right. So, and then because Clifton Collins Jr. became Lawrence, they had to replace El Lazo with a different actor.
El Lazo, we should remind everyone, means the loop in Spanish. So, yeah.
And it was played by Giancarlo Esposito, also known as Gus Fring from Breaking Bad. Did you like freak out a little as I did when you first realized that it was him?
Okay, so like I freaked out like a smidge because his casting wasn't announced, unlike Jonathan Tucker, Peter Mullen, blah, blah, blah. I freaked out a smidge, and then but my bigger freak out was like, oh my God, Dave Chen's going to see this because like I know how you feel about Gus and Giancarlo Esposito, and I was so excited that I got to talk to you about this.
It was it is awesome. Like I was just like geeking out. I'm like, oh my gosh, yeah. I can't believe this is happening. Giancarlo Esposito is a villain in a prestige television show. So awesome. Happened. 5 minutes later, he's dead. You know, like kind of a bummer. I wish we could have seen more of that character.
A little path his face. And we should remind everyone maybe that the last time they were in Pariah was like where they last season there was like that big orgy scene and stuff like that. And so like to come to Pariah now, it's nighttime and you instead of like sexy times with like young nubile bodies, you have just like piles and piles and piles of dead bodies and mice at the feasts and all this sort of stuff. This decay, this rot, this death, this like seedy underbelly of the promise of Pariah that young William and Logan went to in season one. I also like that Giancarlo Esposito called it Santa Paria, which we never heard in season one. I liked that too.
So then William tries to recruit all of these guys to help him. They all kill themselves, including El Lazo. I thought the way this was shot and edited was really compelling. You know, the overhead shot of all of them firing and then falling to the ground. I mean, that's just a crazy, you know, it's just not something you see every day. You know, like you don't see a bunch of dudes self-terminating like that. But it also did feel kind of silly to me, you know. I don't know. What did you think of this sequence?
Yeah, I liked it. I like that Robert can still mess with everyone through his various host avatars. I love that anyone you talk to at the park could be Robert at any time.
Right.
Try to talk to William. I also want to shout out what I think was a Jurassic Park reference when El Lazo talks about going to the circus. Which reminds me of the speech that John Hammond gives in Jurassic Park about the flea circus and stuff like that. Always on the lookout for a Jurassic Park reference. But I liked it. Yeah, it's silly and over the top, but like so is Robert Ford. Robert Ford is a very dramatic human being.
Yeah,
so
I mean, I think it's like, okay, if they're not going to help him, they could just not help him. You know, they don't need to like kill themselves. But it is obviously more dramatic and impressive that they kill themselves. I think I'm kind of curious. Are we going to see the evolution of why Robert would want to fuck with William so much? You know what I mean? Like, it seems like there's a lot of history between those two characters that we're not privy to. And now that we have, like, old William is back in the mix, or younger William, I should say, is back in the mix, I wonder if we're going to see.
You don't think it has anything to do with young William enacting a hostile takeover of his park and turning what Robert Ford wanted, which was like some interesting exploration of AI or whatever, into a creepy business that spies on people and harvests their DNA?
Well,
you don't think that's a reason enough for him to want to mess with
William?
First
of all, I mean, when you say it like that, Joanna, it does make it seem self-evident. But I do also – but what I'm saying is I want to see that stuff.
Okay.
You know?
That's fair. Yeah. But yeah, and then all right, what else do we have in the episode?
That's basically it. You know, like then they ride off, and I think
and then he says the place we're going is my greatest mistake.
Yeah, the place we're going is my greatest mistake, which we've already offered our interpretations on what that could mean. Right.
So given everything that we've talked about in this episode, I want to circle back to the lake and the beach in episode one. Which is like stuff you talked about in this episode. We saw hosts be resurrected. You question the like nature of your reality. You question the nature of what actually is death for hosts. So like it doesn't. I don't know. It feels to me like all those hosts dead in the water are not actually. They're not actually dead in the water, right? So that's where I think.
Well, those hosts could actually be dead because, you know, maybe water messes with circuitry in some way, you know, or.
Sure.
Yeah.
But that to me strikes me as like our possible Trojan horse scenario. Cause like, let's say they are dead and like playing dead. Mm-hmm. And then they take those bodies somewhere. And then you've got a stealth like mass of hosts that could be resurrected and do something.
Mm-hmm.
That's just one idea. And then let's circle back also to who we think is Bernard on the beach and underline the fact that that could, once we talk about uploading different people's brains to mind eggs or consciousness to mind eggs or swapping mind eggs or whatever it is, if you want to talk about Trojan horses again, we don't know who is inside that body, right?
Right.
So it could be anyone. And I will just say, I don't know. Once again, don't know. But I will point out that we have not seen Dolores in that timeline, right? So.
Hmm.
Is that actually Dolores in Bernard's body? I don't know. So.
Well, I've known never to doubt you, Joanna, so I'm not going to deny that that's possible. But I will be interested to see how that theorizing evolves in the weeks to come. So okay. Overall, I thought this was a pretty cool episode. I mean, this episode does one of those things where that some people don't like in other shows, where they kind of do a backdoor pilot. It's like flashes back and tells you how these characters got to this situation. But because this show monkeys around with time so much anyway, it felt very much of a piece. It did not feel out of place or like they're trying to sneak in a pilot in here. And I thought it was creepy and atmospheric at times. And it raises more questions than it answered. But, you know, we're still early on in the season and I'm not ready to be really frustrated with the show yet for not answering everything. So I dug it. I thought it was a solid second episode. What do you think?
Yeah, I love it because it solves one of our biggest sticking points of the season, which is like we don't like Terminator Dolores. So in giving us flashback Dolores, even though she's like very manipulated and frozen and stuff like that, like that's at least a Dolores that I want to like root for and I'm interested in and all this sort of stuff, you know, like you're rooting for her to wake up and figure out what's going on around her. We don't really like what's happened since she woke up, but you know what I mean?
So, it's okay. I'm not as down on it as you are. I don't think it's super interesting, but I think I kind of want to see where it's going. Yeah. And I think it is a very like there's a lot of swagger in that performance that I admire. So anyway, those are our thoughts on this week's episode of Westworld. Hope you enjoyed them. Hope it helped you make sense of this episode because I know a lot of people were really confused and wanting to process it. So thanks for listening. Find more episodes of the show at decodingwestworld.com. Email us at decodingwestworld@gmail.com. Joanna Robinson, where can you find more of your work on the internet this week?
I am doing another Westworld podcast called Still Watching Westworld, which we record before the show airs generally, so it doesn't have as many fun theories because like I'm just watching it in a vacuum by myself. Or you can find me on vanityfair.com or you can follow me on Twitter at Joe Wrote This.
Follow me at Dave Chensky, that's Dave Chen SKY, or subscribe to my YouTube channel at youtube.com/Dave Chensky, that's Dave Chen SKY. Thanks for listening. We'll see you next week.
A lot can happen in 3 years, like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage that lasts nearly 3 years in some states. Learn more at uh1.com.